But let everybody know, you know, that I am absolutely the most spoiled guy on the planet. There are not a lot of preachers who can confront some really difficult passage and then say, Jerry, what does it mean? Which I actually do this week. It's just so nice, you know, to have somebody there and say, well, here, this is where you went off the rails, you know, you need to straighten this out over here. And so I'd like to start tonight with the end of chapter 3, and that, not quite, you know, totally the end, but the next to last verse in chapter 3. We're going to be into chapter 4 here tonight in a little bit, but you remember last week from 3:21, who knows that the breath of man ascends upward, and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth. It is apparently a little bit difficult just to translate that verse. And so I'm going to ask tonight, I'm reading the New American Standard. Who has any other translation than that? Okay, Carl, what do you have? What translation is it? New King James, right, okay. Would you read that aloud for us, please, nice and loud?
Which verse?
21 of chapter 3.
Who knows the spirit of the sons of men which goes upward, the spirit of the animals which goes down to the earth.
Okay. Greg, you had a different one, or was it New King James? Okay. Anybody else who got New American Standard and a New King James? Do you have anything else there? Uh-oh, I see those phones working. Frank's probably got 16 translations in his phone, I'll bet. We can be here all night doing that. You got a different one?
For no one knows whether the spirit of a human ascends to heaven and whether the spirit of a beast descends into the ground.
See how different that is? That's not a question. That's a declaration. Nobody knows. And the other two have said, who knows? As if, I know, this is the answer, but... you know, who does? And then a third way with the question would be, who knows, as if it's not possible to know. And so we've got, you know, wide variety just of translation. So we worked with this, you know, somewhat last week. And then I forget, somebody had already mentioned Ecclesiastes 12:7. I didn't present it. One of you had it. Make sure that at chapter 3, verse 21, you make a note, you know, C-S-E-E. Ecclesiastes 12:7. It certainly bears strongly on this question of how to translate that verse and how to understand it. And look at looking at now chapter 12 and verse 7, which Jerry also immediately directed me to. It says, "The dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it." Now in 12:7, it's not a question; it's a declaration, and there's no difficulty figuring out how to translate it either. So, you know, now you have in this same book, by the same author, same time, you know, the statement, the Spirit will return to the God who gave it. So, make sure you have that in verse 21, because that will seem to take away some of the question marks. And this is what Jerry explained to me, and I'm sure I'm not doing as good a job explaining it to you as he did to me, but, you know, the point is that when you plug in chapter 12 and verse 7, it becomes a fact that... the breath is the way it's translated in the New American Standard, but as we said last week, the exact same word would also be translated air or spirit. Probably then would have been better translated spirit here and would match with 12:7. The spirit of man ascends upward. The breath of the beast, well, it's the same word, should be the spirit of the beast, descends downward to the earth. Now, Jerry just helped me out tremendously, and I haven't got a whole lot of time to be rehearsing it tonight, you know, but we talked about how animals think and human beings think. Animals are emotional, and human beings are emotional. And so both have the capacity for differing degrees, but certainly rational thought. Big deal hit, you know, all the science papers today. I don't know if you saw it on the news, but they have determined that, I can't remember if it's chimpanzees or some other kind of ape, you know, what it was that they were saying, that these monkeys use spears to hunt. Did you know that? See, I didn't either. And they said, but it's not just that. They also sharpen those sticks with their teeth for the end that they're going to use for spearing. Well, that's impressive, isn't it? That's a level of cognitive thought and rational decision making
that we just didn't realize they had. And so, certainly, with wide varying degrees, animals are conscious beings who have a certain degree of self-knowledge and self-evaluation. They will protect their young. They will protect the herd. You have many different, you know, actions there that require both conscious thought and emotions. They are living and active and similar to us. But, looking at 12:7, looking at 3:21, what do you know about the spirit / breath that is in both God, humans and man? At death, what happens? One goes up to the other, you know, back to the earth. It just is vaporized somehow. It does more like what the body does than the spirit of a human being does. And so, hopefully that'll be very helpful. You can ask Jerry about it. He'll do a better job than I did, you know, I'm very sure. But that it is helpful that this is really probably not Solomon either asking an open-ended question or necessarily lamenting that nobody knows this, but he is establishing that it is a fact. Now, apart from having Jerry to keep me on the rails, what are wives for? Same thing. Exactly. And so Donna came up with an idea that I want to make sure to share with everybody tonight too. First time I'd ever heard this idea, backing up another chapter and to the actual last verse in chapter 2, verse 26. All right? To a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner, he has given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after wind. And so we also had quite a bit of discussion that went on with that particular passage. Donna had an idea this week that I just really appreciated. She said, you know, if you think about Solomon in his position as the king and preacher over Israel, of course, but in all of Israeli history, tell me how Solomon is unique as a king. What about his reign is different than any other king? David, his daddy included. Can you name a couple of differences?
Wisdom, knowledge, and peace.
Okay. The very wisdom, knowledge, and peace that's been mentioned, okay, he's the wisest man that ever lived. He's better than David when it comes to that. Okay? They did have peace, where David was a man of war, and as soon as Solomon died, what happened to the kingdom? Immediately considered in a civil war that's going to be that way for hundreds of years. Okay? His son Rehoboam was a fool, like Ecclesiastes also frequently mentions. When he took over, he so infuriated 10 of the tribes that they split and wouldn't have anything to do with the remaining two down in the south, and now you've got a divided kingdom from that point on. It's just terrible, you know, what happens. But in Solomon's reign, absolute peace. Now name for me another one. Financially, what do you have? You have the wealthiest, most comfortable time that Israel will ever know. We are told in one place that the streets were what? Silver was so cheap they could use it for asphalt. Okay, that's doing pretty well. Now, one last thing, and this again has to do with the nature of the kingdom. Territory. What about Solomon's reign when it comes to the borders of Israel?
Biggest
they will ever be, and significantly so. All right? And then, thinking again now about both of those facts, see if you can recall when Solomon gets ready to build the temple and his house. Okay? Humongous building projects. Years for each of them. More years for his house than even for the temple, which he was just following David and God's plans. Okay? Where do materials come from? Neighboring nations. And particularly one's name, King Hiram, from up there in Meyer, who is a Jew, right?
No.
Oh, he's a Gentile. Okay? And we are told about Solomon's dealings with many other kingdoms and spices and all the imports and everything. Okay? And what God said was, you know, maybe what this is about is Solomon recognizing from his position at this time in Jewish history. Who's doing all the gathering and collecting that's making him so wealthy that as he resells these goods and the livestock, and where is he getting all the materials that he's doing? Who's doing all the collecting? Do you remember the tens of thousands that were employed by Hiram as they were bringing all that cedar down from the forests of Lebanon? Okay? Isn't that an interesting take on that? Okay? So she's saying, maybe that's what he's talking about. So I was looking out there. Here we are, the Jews, trying to be faithful to our God. And out there are all these other nations, and they're still ungodly and idolatrous, and they're sinners. But look at what they're doing for us. And now we have all this joy in the wealthiest, largest, most comfortable time that Israel is ever going to know. So, a little bit of catch-up on those two passages. Let's turn now to some ugliness in chapter 4. Wise as he is, as very capable as he is as an administrator, he's able to accomplish all the things we've just been talking about. He says in chapter 4, verse 1, "Oh, you're nonetheless, then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were done under the sun. Behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort." To comfort them is the idea, of course. Okay?
Now, as I mentioned, I think in the introductory night, it's sometimes frustrating to me when you do read a bunch of commentaries, you know, and you collect all this scholarly and see what people say, you know, and a significant number of people were trying to argue that King Solomon did not write this book, and that because he was the wisest and most capable king that Israel ever saw, and so surely you wouldn't have all that oppression. He would have eliminated it all. He didn't live at the time when that was true in Israel. Now what's the problem with him arguing that Solomon couldn't have written this because whoever is writing it is talking about a time when there wouldn't have been any oppression under Solomon. It has to be somebody else some other time. How would you answer that?
Well, when the Israelites asked for a king, God told them that he would, that the king would oppress them as far as the their sons and daughters and tithes and to keep the kingship going. So in that way, they are oppressed. And then as the Pharisees and the Sadducees are that way when Jesus is here, they were out still taking advantage of widows and orphans and everything else. So regular men still do what they do.
Okay, and on both counts, there's really two examples there. You know, Carol's absolutely right that a good king does not ensure that everybody below him is wise and righteous, does it? What has Solomon already said about his own kids and everybody else's? Who knows whether they'll be wise or foolish? And often it's not. What are they? They're foolish. See, he's going to lament that, already has it, and he will again. Okay, so there's no argument at all that he would have banished all unrighteousness. You can't control people that well, as Carol's been pointing out. Now, one other thing, though, it's getting to be halfway, and I need to get deeper in this chapter, so I'll take too much time here, but let me ask you this. Solomon beholds oppression. In that verse, look carefully, you can see. He never lifted his eyeballs over the borders of Israel, did he? In other words, could he have seen oppression in the neighboring lands? He's dealing extensively and regularly with Hiram, and all the Queen of Sheba came to visit him. Now he, you know, or Sheba rather, but out of Egyptian area. Why is it necessary that we limit this to what's going on in Israel? No reason at all. See? So Solomon wrote the book. And those that try to reduce our confidence in it, you know, and suggest that he's
let's just make the book tell a lie. It's Solomon, and now it's not. Preacher, he came to Israel. So that kind of stuff, just really holds no water. The man was dealing with circumstances the way everybody deals with circumstances, why as he was. Billy, yeah, come in.
That was exactly the point I was going to make. It doesn't say here that it was only in his own country.
Okay, so there you go. So he's just wise enough to be able to see there's always going to be oppression in the world, and it's awful, isn't it? I just have a hard time even watching the news anymore, don't you? And you read about how many millions have been massacred in Syria, in Iraq, in Iran, in Pakistan, and all these different places, where they have all these sectarian wars going on, and you see these people run out of their homes to one city, entire cities at a time. The ISIS is assailing Ramadi, as we talked, right now. And it looks very like it's 50-50. It's going to go either way. They take Ramadi, they've taken the enormous town and the bloodshed and the devastation, it's going to be horrible. Once they get in there, getting them back out again is terrible. And then even if you cast them out, everything has been wrecked. It takes decades to rebuild. And you see picture after endless picture on the news of people out in the wilderness, in the weather, lost their homes, their businesses, starving, refugee camps, all this stuff going on. What was happening in Solomon's time too? And nobody to comfort. So in 2, I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. And better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun. And that, of course, is one of the very darkest passages in the book, and causes people to just think, the man was just clinically depressed, and so it's just really a downer of a book. Well, a human being, brethren, if they have any sense of normalcy about them, is upset when you see these things going on and recognize that there is not anything you can do. There's a time for everything. And when these things are going on, you just simply have to wait for God's own time when those things get sorted out in God's own way. Often enough, you are absolutely helpless to do anything about it. That's the way it is, and that's the way it's going to be. Now, here's an interesting little layer, though. Solomon is the wisest man that ever lived. And he just said two things. Better to die when you're in such circumstances as those, and better never to have ever lived so as to risk these circumstances in circumstances like those. Okay? Now, was he wrong? He's really not wrong. And now, I just want to make, gentle and kindly kind of an observation. Brethren, it really is not right when we say to people that if they never want to marry and have children, that there must be something wrong with them. Don't you know all the joy that children will bring? Yeah, what else do they bring? Deadness, poverty, and greed. But we kind of have a tendency, or at least I hear it an awful lot, as I speak with Christians, almost an air of superiority that this is the only right way, and if people don't do that, then there's something wrong with them. It's real selfish. Okay? What did Solomon say? That is not an unreasonable position. It is very logical, it is very rational, and if you don't want to bring children into this world, then, what did Paul say about it in 1 Corinthians 7? First thing he said was, fine, it's good for a man not to touch a woman, that is. You don't have to be involved in a marriage and sexual activity and producing children. You really don't. So I just toss that out there, lest we forget that really there are two sides to every coin. And when a person chooses to be single, chooses not to have children, that is not some sort of necessary character flaw. It doesn't make him any lesser of a human being. Solomon reached the same conclusion, and I guess that's a pretty defensible position then, It is true. If you choose to go the route of marrying and having children, you will open the door to an enormous number of problems and disappointments and heartaches that you will not have. And then, at great length, Paul pointed out, you will also be free to be more active in spiritual things and in the service of your God if you choose that path. They are utterly and completely equal. Never forget it. They are as viable and acceptable and as beautiful and as right in God's eyes as the other. No one better than the other. So, I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. Better off than both of them, so one who never existed, who's never seen the evil activity that's done under the sun. And, verse 4, I've seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This, too, is vanity and striving after wind. You ever heard it said it's a dog-eat-dog world out there? Is it? Yes! Okay? Yes! I have a couple of dangerous trees in my backyard. I did the Yellow Pages, and I did the Internet, and I did Google Earth. There's three different ways to find out who has the skill and the tackle to be able to rope themselves up into trees and 20 feet high, lop off branches that are about a foot in diameter. That's dangerous work. And I got a postage stamp of a backyard and a fence as well as a house to protect. Very, very dangerous work. So I just line them up. Over a dozen guys in the last 2 days, I had one after another cutting my yard, look at those two trees, and give me a bid. Okay? And that's fun, isn't it? First thing you do is just have to get several bids. Immediately, a couple hundred bucks comes off the top. Wait till they put it in writing, then tell them, see what happens. And so, I've got bids for the same two trees, brethren, from $475 to $1,200. These trees were a lot taller than I thought they were. You know? And then, I tell them, I'm getting several bids, and what immediately happens? $1,200 went to $1,000. $1,000 went to $875. They don't like that. What's going on? Rivalry. Competition. Hunger. See? What's going on is business. Capitalism. Okay? Solomon understood it. He was the best trader in the world at the time. We read the lists of all the products that he had and how he acted as a wholesaler over here and resold over there, you know, and all that he was doing. Simple fact, every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. They're all trying to be the best, do the job the best, and thereby profit the most. That's the way it works. Are you ever going to fix that? No. Is it bad? Now be careful. What does he say at the end? It is vanity and striving after wind. Is there a difference between that and bad? If you've been reading carefully, you're discovering there's quite a few things that are vanity and striving after wind that he still tells us what? Go do it vigorously. It's vanity and striving after wind, but go do it. And your labor, chief among them, as we've studied several times. And so, it's not that it's wrong. It's not that it's bad. It's just that it is, and it's frustrating, and it's too bad, and you know, in that, it does then produce sometimes very hard feelings, there are things that flow from it, and all the rest of that. There can be bad things that flow from that. There's been murder that flows out of that. There's also what that comes from that rivalry? Excellence. Exactly. Guys who get to be really, really skillful. And that's good, isn't it? Sure it is. So, Solomon's book is just a wonder of balancings and evaluatings and then teaching you. Learn how to live with vanity and futility and striving after wind, because it's never going away. And if you'll accept that that is the way life works, You can relax and be happy about it, learn how to work with it, and learn how to profit from it as well. This is what Solomon's trying to do. The unvarnished truth. Get it all figured out. And then, look at it, pluses and negatives and pros and cons, and put it all together. When you're wise, what happens to your life? What is Solomon trying to accomplish? Carol had a minute ago, the triumvirate. Wisdom, knowledge, and yes, / joy. Okay? Billy had a comment.
I had a question.
Okay.
This first part of verse 4, a man is envied of his neighbor. Is envy necessarily a bad thing here?
Your translation has envy in the place of rivalry between a man and his neighbor.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah, no, it's exactly the same idea, and it's just a translation deal. We do think of envy as being a simple thing. It's in the list of sin in the New Testament. Okay? But what it has to do with is only that there is this conflict. You're seeing the other guy, you're measuring yourself against him, you're thinking up and down and trying to get up. Over there, and it comes down to exactly the same thought translation. You know, it's kind of like, I think all of you will know this, what is the difference in the New Testament words zealous and jealous? What's the difference in those words? It's absolutely none, because it's the same word. Exactly the same word. And so they have to do with a passionate feeling, which in jealousy is, I feel robbed of something that belongs to me. But then we translate the identical same word as zealous, and what do we get? Passionate for something. And now it's positive. It's kind of like that. He's just focusing on the conflict, you know, as you're in the competition. Okay, verse 5 of chapter 4. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. A fool folds his hands. What's the picture? A slacker. Lazy. He's not working. He's indolent. All right? And that is very foolish. He's been telling us about the profit that lies in labor itself, as well as the income that it can bring, already in these first chapters, and we'll be doing a great deal more to come in the book. And so, if you got a fool who is not going to work, then what happens? Consumes his own flesh. You're just going to wither and starve, and that both physically as well as if you view all your possessions, you know, in your bank account, you know, as being fat and happy, you know, that stuff's just going to wither away. You're not laboring. You're not working. It's, you're not going to prosper, therefore. You're not going to grow. That's a very foolish thing to do. And you're just devouring your own self. You're not getting anything in, but you're still going to eat, you know, and so you're just going downhill. Then he says in verse 6, and remember from 2 weeks ago, I think it was, I gave you the list of all the good things that are in the book, passages where a very positive thing is stated. There's another one in 4, verse 6. One hand full of rest is better than two fists full of what? Labor and striving after wind. And he's been telling us how good labor is. He's been also telling us how pointless great wealth is, because you're never going to be satisfied with it. You're always going to want more. That's the way it works. Okay? But what did he just now tell you, and I used the word a little while ago, if this hand's got rest and this hand's got labor, what have you done? You balance them. So he's been telling us about the profit of labor. He's highly recommending labor. He's expecting us to be very, very energetic in our work. We also want to understand, we've been the word for this, that the workaholic is really a bad thing. So, get that one handful of that labor, what do you do with the other? Learn how to rest. Learn how to recreate. You know, learn how to balance this out. You can cure yourself striving after wind, or you can learn how to enjoy it properly and get your proper rest as well. Okay? Thought maybe I saw the flash of a hand going out somewhere. Bill.
My American Standard says a handful with quietness, which to me
Well, again, it's just a translation, but it's getting to exactly the same place.
If you are at rest, you are at peace. And a thing, as a matter of fact, we have rest, and then we have the word restive. What does restive mean?
Completely different.
That's the opposite. It's the same word, but now it means never relaxing, you know, never working. But the point is that however you translate it, the thought is exactly the same, isn't it? One hand's with this, and it's the opposite of what's in the other hand. Learn to balance it out.
Okay, verse 7. Then I look again at vanity under the sun. It was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches. And for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? Solomon puts those words in that man's mouth. This, too, is vanity, and it is a grievous task. Now, after what he just said in verse 6, what is the guy in verse 8? He's the guy who didn't accept verse 6. He didn't get it. And so now, he's got two fits full of what? Full of labor. He doesn't know how. We use this expression all the time. He just can't let it go. Okay? Well, one hand needs to be trained to let it go. And the other hand needs to be trained to gather it in. When you balance these things out, you're no longer a fool, and you'll be a lot happier. So it is a grievous thing, and it's a terrible thing. And in the last part of verse 8, long verse, for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is vanity. It's a grievous task. If both hands are full of labor, then what must you be depriving yourself of?
Rest
in 6 and pleasure in 8. Okay? Now, pleasure has no place in our lives, right? No, Solomon's been telling us pleasure's great. He explores pleasure to its fullest extent. It's vanity, but it's also what? It's great. It's a lot of fun. Okay? So it's vanity only because can you ever get enough? No. We call that a hedonist. It's somebody who can't stop. The only thing they do, you know, think about gratifying the flesh. What is Solomon saying? Learn how to balance it out. See? The fool folds his hands and gives his life to pleasure and withers away. The other fool fills both fists with labor, no matter how much he acquires, he's never satisfied with it. This guy didn't even have any overhead. Didn't have a son, didn't have a brother, didn't have anybody he had to take care of it. He's never going to be satisfied. So what he's saying is, learn how to find balance in life. Paul said, I have learned to be content in whatever circumstance. See? There's the genius. Now 9. Interesting little passage here. A couple of verses on the same topic. It gives you several illustrations. 2 are better than 1 because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there's not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if 2 lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, 2 can resist him. A cord, this is the 4th illustration, of 3 strands, is not quickly torn apart. What's the lesson? Okay, now, true or false? No man is an island. False. There's lots of men that are islands. They're recluses and Ted Kaczynski types. You can be one. The statement is false that no man is an island didn't come out of the Bible. Okay? There are guys who try to do that. Next question. Okay? Are you foolish or wise if you become an island? Foolish. Now, who's the only person you can depend on? You. Eventually, you are going to fail. That's just inevitable. You get old. Anybody trying to stop that? Yeah, me too. Good luck with that.
He's not going to win that battle. Okay? So what is he saying? There's safety in
numbers.
We teach this from childhood. And it's true. There's safety in numbers. And a whole bunch of problems that come with that. You know? And that's what Solomon's telling us all throughout the book. But he's also guiding us on what is better and what is worse. So that, in this great, confusing mess of things we call life, that has got more problems than there are stars in the sky above, you're going to bump into your fair share. Learn how to keep your balance. And part of that is going to learn how to get along with other people. I started yesterday the most fascinating and wonderful thing. My dad died 3 years ago next month. And for the 30 years before he died, he kept journals and forbid anybody in the family to read them until after he passed. And my brother sent me a 40-pound box of journals, 30 of them yesterday. Amazing reading. Okay? Now, one of the things I'm finding out is that there was a range war going on between my dad and the neighbor next door. They couldn't figure out how to get along. That's not good. You know? And my dad, and I love my dad, really did. He was a great guy. But he really did tend to be more on the isolationist side. He didn't have a whole lot of friends, very few. He stayed home all the time. You couldn't pay him to go to a party. You know, that just didn't ever happen. Very almost reclusive kind of a guy. Okay? And when something went wrong, what? It was on him. See? Didn't have a whole lot of people he could call, you know, for help and be supported. So, four different ways, he just says, are social activities and learning how to interact and work with other people a good thing or a bad thing? They're a good thing. You've got four illustrations. You know, to go along with that. Now, so you guys can dig this out, and I'm not sure I'll remember either, so we'll turn to Jerry here in a minute. But the last verse in Luke chapter 2 says that Jesus, as a child, continued to grow in four things. Can you remember what they were? It was wisdom, strength or stature. Then there were two that started with the word favor. Favor with God and favor with man. Favor God alone. Okay? Now, what is wisdom? See? This is intelligence and thought. What was the stature / strength? His body. What is favor with God? His spirit. What is favor with man? Favor with man is being able to work with people. He learned how to be a social and not an island individual. He was not an isolationist. He was good at working with people. Now, I think that verse is there because we're all supposed to grow that way. There are four parts to human nature. You have a mind, a body, and then you have a spirit that has to interact with both God and man. Now, develop yourself in all four areas. Teach your children how to do it. Find that balance. You can do it. See? In working with people. And if you pull that off, if you carefully and consciously work to develop your knowledge base so that you become a wise person, and you carefully consider how to be an individual that takes care of their bodies, you'll likely live longer. And if you're careful about your relationship with God and your relationship with man, are you going to enjoy life more or less? A whole lot more. My dad probably would not have had the next door neighbor using the vacant lot that was behind my dad for target practice with his pistol so much if they had learned how to get along. Should bug my dad and go to the journal. All right? But they weren't on speaking terms either. So, work it out. Find the balance. Chapter 4, verse 13. And this will take us to the end of the chapter. And one thought, if you want to link the verses somehow. A poor, yet wise lad, so a youngster, is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows to receive instruction. Oh, that hurts, doesn't it? What is critically important to your dying day? Learning how to receive instruction. Not thinking that you just absolutely know more than everybody else that there is. See? You've got, no matter how much experience you've got, you've been king over the land. You still need to learn how to listen to people right to the end, how to take instruction. Now, verse 14 continues the thought, F-O-R, in verse 14, for or because he, and that's the poor yet wise lad, has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. Well, verse 13, the only poor person was the wise young lad. Now, he's going all the way up. He's going to make it to the top. He becomes king. Verse 15, uh-oh. So we've already had a big reversal from poor, imprisoned, wise lad. He takes the place of the foolish old king who can't learn instruction. And at 15, I've seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. Now we've had three kings. There's no end to all the people, to all who were before them. And even the ones who come later will not be happy with him. For this too is vanity and striving after wind. Okay, so you have a poor yet wise lad. Okay, is that better than an old and foolish king? Yeah, that's better. Okay? Next, because he's wise, what has he obviously overcome? His poverty and social status, and he worked his way that way to all the way to the top. He became king. And that made him the most popular guy in the whole land, didn't it? No. Instead, it just increased the number of people that hate his guts. Because that's the way it works. Okay? You can't please everybody. It does not matter. If you're really poor, that means everybody can love you? If you're really rich, that means everybody can love you? No. You're in prison. You're the king. What's the difference? What if you feel more comfortable on the physical side? But on the social side, well, miserable luck. We're getting ready to do it again. How many people do we have running for president now? With every one of us. The overriding thing, you know, that just always strikes me is what kind of a nutcase would want to be president? And what is wrong with you? Have you no sense at all? But we're going to vote for one of those numbskulls, aren't we? See? That's craziness. It's just nothing but problems and unhappiness. So, yeah, I understand there's all kinds of motivations, and we can all second guess and play armchair psychiatrist on why Hillary wants to do it as opposed to Marco Rubio, and then there's Jeb, you know, and who knows, maybe Trump is the best guy. I don't know. I do not know. See? But all of us are crazy. What does this verse teach? It's lonely at the top. Just as lonely at the bottom. Okay? Just the way the world works. Okay? What a sad verse 16. There's no end to all the people who were before them, these two kings, and the ones who come later will not be happy with him, because this too, brethren, is what? And, okay? So now, what are you supposed to do about it? Find balance, okay, and learn how to be, fill the blank from Paul, content, whatever place you find yourself, okay? But if you're at the bottom, you're as poor as you can be, then what? Be wise. And if you're at the top, then what? Same thing. Be wise, okay? and recognize, though, probably the best ground is where? Somewhere in the middle there, brethren, if we could just learn to be content. If we just could do that, probably be okay. Not sure. I may hold the world's record in the United States Army for being a specialist fourth class for the longest time. Okay? And they come to me, we want to make you a sergeant. We're going to pay you more money if you become a sergeant. I'm looking at this, and I think, oh, do I really need this promotion? What was the only difference going to be? Well, there were two. There were two differences between those stations. If I took the promotion, I was going to make more money. And, we're talking now, you know, 40 years ago, but at that time, it also meant you stepped over one very bold line. You went from the highest pay grade you could have, in which you did not have command, and therefore responsibility, over anybody, to the lowest position you could have, where suddenly you are responsible not only for yourself, but for what? Everybody else. I think in my 3 years in the service, I spent 2 years and 9 months as a specialist fourth class. Because I was chicken. You can't think, why do I want all their problems? I mean, look at that sergeant. Does he look happy? No, he doesn't. Is the pay going to be enough to compensate? No, it's not. Where did I want to be? In the middle. No responsibility. Most pay I can get for nothing. Okay. And then I shipped out of the Army happy as I could be. Okay? Find the middle. Be content. Comment or question?